You've been winning some awards. You are transforming your family business into an investment vehicle. You're accepting outside clients. You're both very young, and now Polly is accepting an award today with a nice car. You can mention what kind of a car is he going to drive away today from Frankfurt, where I'm finding you.
So yes, Polly is our youngest brother, and as I said before, we are five boys. So because we were talking a lot about childhood at the beginning, and we need to really thank there also our mother, mm-hmm. because Bogumil, as you can imagine, we are five boys, and the main topics on our dinner table were investments and cars.
And every dinner, really. not only in the night, but also on the middle of the day. And also sometimes when we went for coffee, also like all time only investing, economics, whatever.
And back then we didn't appreciate what my mother was doing for us back then, because she obviously would have topics she wanted to talk more about. But she also, I think in retrospect, invested really a lot of her time, of her hobbies, and she like put her interests back for us to learn more about investing and cars, but it's not so important. But
welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guests today are Jacob and Tobias Schauber. Jacob and Tobias have been called the youngest portfolio managers in Europe. They are two out of five brothers. They grew up around business and investing and started earlier than most. I had the pleasure of spending some quality time with them in Zurich last summer. They shared with me stories that I knew belonged on Talking Billions, including a transition from running a family business to managing a portfolio of investments and beyond. It was one of those conversations that truly stayed with me, and I feel very blessed and fortunate to be able to continue our discussion here today. Their TIP, the Investor Partners, is an Austria-based value investment firm inspired by the Buffett's partnership. In their beginnings, the Schauber brothers have been awarded several prizes in stock picking contests. As someone who loves complex questions being broken down into sound equations, Tobias is a great fan of Bruce Greenwald's theoretical work. As such, he specializes in stock buybacks and issuance, since their simplicity tends to confuse the investing crowd. As a former race driver, it's easy for Jacob to stay calm in turbulent times. Today we talk about their very early fascination with investing, family dinners with stock discussions, and a story of a family business that preceded it all. They share how they discovered the power of compounding and decided to start before they became teenagers. We touch on the topic of age and what's it like to venture into investment world at such a young age. They might be young, but they have a few crises under their belt, including getting started before the 2008-2009 financial crisis. My guests tell me what kind of businesses they look for. Stay tuned until the end when Jacob and Tobias share some fascinating research about buyback policies when companies return capital to shareholders. When we recorded, I found out that Jacob and Tobias were in Germany at the time at a stock investing competition where their brother Polly was accepting an award. We talk about that as well and about the car that Polly received as an award. Please help me welcome Jacob and Tobias. Hi, how are you? Jacob, Tobias, it's nice to see you.
Really nice seeing you. Hi, Bogman.
Thank you very much for the great invitation here to be on your podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've been looking forward to it. And we met in Zurich at John Michaljevic's MMY Global, and we had a nice dinner. And you both shared with me your story, and you talked about your investment career. And there's a lot to dive into today. But before I ask you about that, I want to bring up something that's more current that you told me about briefly before we started talking. Your brother, who is not with us today, is accepting an award. So tell me more about that award. And I do know that you both received those awards before. What are they? What's it all about? And why it's so exciting?
I mean, it's like a stock picking contest. So we are used to playing those in Austria, like our home country. And there are always like several thousand traders, more or less, playing there. And the thing is, what we found out quite when, I mean, we played our first one, we had our first prize when I was 8 and Jacob was 12 or 13.
So you started very early in the investment world. How old were you and how old are you now?
I'm 24. Jacob is 29, I think he got 29. And yeah, we started really early, and this was all thanks to my dad. And yeah, that was like always when we have like this family business, very small wood company. And that struggled kind of when the expansion in Europe happened. Mm-hmm. And because like in some other countries, prices are like way lower and they can produce at way lower prices. So especially like wood is not that most complicated stuff to produce. And so what he did was not reinvesting in the company, because the ROIC that he would have received was like way below cost of capital. And so he started to get interested in Warren Buffett. And I was always like the mathematical guy, and I always loved that. And so we, like every dinner, we talked about finance and all that stuff. And yes, so I think all of that really is thanks to our dad.
So, Jacob, a question for you both, but I'm curious, and I'd like to explore more how you think that early time, the childhood and upbringing, influenced your career and your relationship with money. And Tobias, you touched on it, but I'm curious to hear more. What are your memories that shaped you?
It actually influenced it very heavily, because when I remember back, it was always the whole investing and the whole talking about returns and about investments and stocks was from childhood on a big part in our family. And I remember actually quite well when we were kids and our father, so we are actually 5 brothers in total, but I remember quite well when our father was actually sitting there on the dinner with us and like talking about compounded interest. And therefore, he made like a list with, I don't know, like 50 years. And he said, like, let's start with 1,000 euros and then compound it year by year with about 15%. So it was actually amazing how this turned out in 50 years. And when we were kids, we were like, wow, this is amazing. We need to start thinking about stocks. And I got these ideas from Tobias when he was extremely quick in finding out that he needs to earn money now, which he can put in stocks and let it compound.
And you have a benefit of a longer runway. Buffett says that you should find that snowball and then find the tallest hill and just roll it down. And since you started as teenagers.
Yeah, exactly. Like my hourly wage, I think the best I ever had in my life was when I was 8 or so, or 7, like, because I earned like four euros, three, four, 5 euros. That it got like more when, because I was like trimming the grass in our garden. And I did that also quite a lot. Because I thought about the compound interest, and I thought like that would be so much money when I'm older. And I had like a 20-fold on those, so like $100 or euros an hour, which is like good.
This was actually crazy.
Go ahead.
This was actually crazy because for Tobias it was like earning money, but at the same time for our parents, they were able with that to teach us the principles of economic or capitalism, the principles of compound interest. And what helped really a lot was for them was that suddenly they had a really cheap worker with Tobias.
But it's a great lesson in the value of money. It kind of gives you a better context. I wrote an article, I called it Precious Dollars, but it could be Precious Euros and anything else. The idea was that to really think about savings, what it took for you to have that 10 or 100 or 1,000 euro to start with, that it took a lot of, you know, compromise and sacrifice and work. So when you put it at risk and you invest it, it gives you a different context. Losing it means something to you.
Exactly.
So you've been called the youngest portfolio managers in Europe, and your brother is, that's not with us, Pauli, is 20. You guys are in your 20s. Tell me more about the whole experience of getting into investment business at such a young age, what it's been like, and now you're running an investment firm with outside clients, if I'm correct. Tell me more what it's been like, especially in Europe. You know, I spent half of my life in Europe. In Europe, people always told me that you have to wait until you have gray hair on your side to speak up in the room. What it's been like to run an investment firm in Europe at such a young age?
Yes, you couldn't call it better. But actually, I don't know if we are really the youngest portfolio manager. There was just one article who managed it, but I'm not sure 100% about that. But obviously, you're right. We have in our age we have not a lot of competitors because all the others have much more experience than we do. So I think for a lot of our clients, they like it because it gives them like a fresh wind, if I could say so.
And it also gives like sometimes really a lot of advantages. One is like, for example, we had this company last year, which is quite famous and which went up like a lot through the year. But the problem there was that actually, and people still don't really know why it went up so much. They have different reasons that they think about, but really it was a lot about like the risk, because all the young people thought there is so much risk in it as no one is going to use it anymore in 5 to 10 years time. But the thing is, no one of the young ones was able to think like in balance sheet terms, because that's like out kinda. They don't think about balance sheets. They don't even look at it sometimes. And like the old people, like the ones with gray hair, all they do is like think about balance sheets and that stuff. Uh-huh. And so, but they did not understand the business really from a qualitative perspective. And so you had those two groups of people who for totally different reasons were not able to understand that business. And if you're quite young and you use it a lot, but still have like that old thinking, like, from like Buffett style boring value thinking, then this really is a great advantage sometimes, because you are quite alone. I mean, it's lonely sometimes from that perspective because everyone is older, but it gives you great advantages too.
What's it like when you sit down with a prospective client and they look at you and they say, are you ready for it?
I mean, you're totally right. But the good thing is, and it wasn't actually planned that we take outside money. So what our path actually for the last several years was more like we have this family business and our father teached us in the terms of valuing companies and stuff like that. But then we won these stock picking games and therefore quite a lot of outside investors came to us and asked us if we can invest for them as well. And that's actually how we got the customers. And then we made all the exams and all the regulatory framework and correct. And then we started. So this actually helped us to start the snowball. And because thankfully the clients are happy with us, they bring us new customers. And yes, it's why it's working quite well, I would say.
Yeah, we have like no marketing whatsoever. It's like the only thing that we do is we try to help as much as we can with our time. And there's like a lot of things that one can do in Austria because economically it's well ahead sometimes in terms of other like the overall wealth that there is, but from the knowledge it really isn't that good, and so there's a lot of sometimes like kind of frauds, and there is stuff where you can there's like this insurances and whatever that want way too much money, and they are so complex so that no one understands it. And what we do is we talk to people that have those a lot and explain them how they calculate it and what is actually written in there over those 30 pages. And we try them to solve those. And so we get like, we just like get the customers by word of mouth.
No, it's a great approach. And you're based in Vienna, but you invest globally from what I know.
Correct.
So, exactly.
So Tobias is actually more or less based in Vienna. I and the family business is in Salzburg. So, but funnily, we don't invest actually in Austria. As you said, we have a focus on the US and actually companies outside of Europe. But yeah.
A global thing mandate.
Is, we want to diversify them away, our clients from Austria, because they have their jobs and all their money and everything, their houses in Austria. And there is always, people talk about those currency risks, but actually, I think this is the wrong term in many cases, because actually it's like the currency hedges. Kind of like if the euro fails, I mean, the chances are very low per year, but this is like a typical Kelly optimization where you never should be invested just in one geography.
That's a good point. There are so many interesting things that you're touching on. The fact that you have a family business, and I've worked with families that have had money for over multiple generations, and I see that transition at some point where the family has the original business that created the wealth. And there's this moment of revelation when they understand that to keep the wealth going forward, it might be a different business, even a different location, and probably a collection of businesses, a portfolio of businesses that will allow them to compound wealth beyond that, because the original business might not be as attractive as it used to be in the past. And obviously, you know, Buffett's Berkshire and the textile industry is a prime example of it. When he stepped in, and he had no, you know, family ties to the business, but he saw the future for the capital in very different industries. And I see that your father saw that, and now you're continuing on that path of reinvesting that capital in a whole variety of businesses. And you don't limit yourself to just Austria. If anything, you look globally at businesses and opportunities. I want to ask you about your first stock, first memorable stock for both of you. What was it? What made it memorable?
I mean, it's yeah. So the first company, it's a little different actually for Jacob and me, because I started a little earlier, and mine was Coca-Cola. And I remember this Simpsons episode where they spoke about stocks, and I was like, this was the first time I started talking with my dad about those. And then actually he gave me, he for himself, he bought some Coca-Cola and he gave me some stocks because he wanted me to get hooked on it. And really, that's where the addiction started. And it was like, it was just really like magic for me. That theory that you can really invest in a company and then you get like for every Coca-Cola that is drank in there, you just get a share of it. And so you have like, you have that volatility, the share price, of course, but you have really through the earnings of the company, which are in Coca-Cola's case quite stable, actually. I mean, they hover a little bit, but still you have that trajectory, which is positive every day. And this is still today that for me is mind blowing because people overlook that trajectory because it's so small daily, but it still is there.
Did you feel like an owner of a business holding those
shares? Yeah, I mean, so there's even, probably it's not healthy, and also like from my parents' point of view, what maybe not a good idea because we're all addicted now, but like we drank every dinner, we drink Coca-Cola, and we just, it's like difficult to drink something else. I mean, now that I live alone, like sometimes I drink like more water, but still.
Well, Coca-Cola sells water too, so you could explore all the other offerings that they have.
Yeah, but we are too cheap for that because in Austria, like the free water is so good.
There
so
you
I don't
go.
Want to pay.
Don't pay for it. Now that's remarkable that you are both a consumer and a shareholder. I think that's the perfect place to be. It's not always the case because sometimes, you know, we invest in businesses that we don't directly use the services or goods. So it's nice to have that option too. But when you can also benefit from the services or goods of the company and be a shareholder at the same time, it's a nice feeling when you think that the money's somehow coming back to you, even if you're a smaller shareholder at the beginning. Well, Jacob, tell me about your first stock, the one that's memorable. What was it? Why was it memorable?
So I think there were actually two stocks which are very memorable. The first one, I think, was, I mean, Toby pointed it out quickly before, was when we won our first prize in a stock prize giving it in 2008, I think it was. So in the middle of the financial crisis, and we just bought the first stocks in 2007 for our personal account. So we got this, this crisis, but for us, it was actually a great time to buy more of our favorite stocks. And then what changed or what was my first experience with a stock when it comes to evaluating was in 2013. We bought some Microsoft stocks. I mean, we already bought the first Microsoft stocks in 2008 and it was down for, I don't know, for about 4 years or something like that. But we keep on getting more and more. And maybe you and the audience can remember when Microsoft bought Nokia. And what was super interesting back then is I think I was about 16 years old or 18 years
younger,
old.
Younger, right?
And
a bit like 15, yeah, 14.
But
doesn't matter.
But what was funny was
you were young.
Yes, but what was funny though was Microsoft bought Nokia for about 8 billion, between 7 and 8 billion. I can't remember correctly. But on this day, when the announcement got out, the stock was falling for about 7 or 8%. So the market cap of Microsoft was falling for $20 billion for a purchase price worth only $7 billion. And this was actually our first time when we got to see, there could be overreactions in the stock markets. And this was our beloved story for so many months thereafter. And I still think this is my favorite story back then when it comes to the first experiences with investing.
I mean, we could still argue here that, like, for example, there's like the because they do such a bad job on Nokia, they will lose way more than just the Nokia part, which actually happened after that. But like, still, they were like so very pessimistic that even if there was a silver lining or whatever, just a very, very, very small one, and we include that, it's like total overreaction.
It took a lot of commitment and conviction to buy after losing money in it from what it sounds like. You know, for 4 years, it was not a performing stock. And here they're making a decision that it sounded like you were not a fan of. And the market was definitely not praising them for it. And you still stepped in. I mean, if that's not contrarian, I don't know what is. But it took a lot of conviction to step in. So go ahead.
No, I just wanted to point out this contrarian mindset is actually also in our family a really big part. And sometimes it makes it difficult also in our duo with between Tobias and me, because we both are contrarian. So we always try to fight the other's ideas. I mean, this has some advantages, but it is quite exhausting. I can tell.
It's always fun at dinner table. Because, like, there's first the sorting out always where everyone picks his opinion, opposing the other opinions, and then everyone just argues. Like that's like his all his life has been this idea, but actually it's like the totally opposing one, but we just love to not give.
That's a terrific way to go about it, because it improves the quality of your work. It makes you really go deep and build an argument.
We hope you're right, Bogomil.
I haven't been at your dinner table, but I can only imagine.
If you're the next time in Salzburg, obviously you are really invited to come.
Oh, that would be a pleasure. I'm afraid to bring any stock recommendation to that table. I have to prepare for it.
It will be
but
fun.
I want to ask you about a big picture investment strategy. How do you look at it if somebody asks you, what kind of investments do you make? And I'm getting a flavor for what kind of businesses you like. But in a nutshell, what are you looking for? How long do you want to hold those businesses? What kind of businesses meet your criteria?
So there's like strategy. I mean, there is not one strategy because there's like a plethora of all, and it's like an accumulation of all of those, which are like important. But one big theme that we see with our investments, and that's what we really like. We think of ourselves as a little bit stupid sometimes, like not like really like intelligent, going for the extremely difficult cases. And like, if you think that you want to, like Buffett says, you want to not have a high hurdle, you want those hurdles that you can step over. So you don't need that really high IQ. And one of the themes there is sometimes many investors that try to quantify the intensity of some decisions. So, for example, some stock does something, company does something good, and the stock goes up 5%. Then people think that, like, yeah, that should be worth 10%, and then they buy. But it's really difficult to get those intensities right. And so what we think about more is, like, the quality, kind of. So, for example, what happens rarely, but this is like always the easiest buy for us, is if something like people perceive some action like to be negative, but it's just because it in their intuition it is negative, and sometimes it even is positive. And then you don't have to get the intensity right, and that's like really, really good buy.
So basically, what we did and what I just told you, Bogomil, with the Microsoft story 10 years ago, it is similar, but I think it was back then, it was just with much less detail than what we are looking now. And I would say a big and important thing is when what changed our approach actually in the last few years was when listening to Buffett and when listening to all value investments or value investors and their strategies, it's hard to find like a real, like the real numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So when, especially in the, I think in the last years, Tobias really focused on Bruce Greenwald's work from the Columbia mm-hmm. University, and especially the book from Graham to Buffett and Beyond.
Yeah, the second edition is a good one. Yes, the first one is not, I mean, it's good, but it's not that good. Like even Greenwald says, it's crap. That's what he said. But like the second one really is like totally like for a year, it was my Bible.
And uh-huh. this changed really our way of putting numbers into quality and putting numbers uh-huh. and finding out the variables and the inputs we need to get a real price what we want to buy.
Yeah, and that's like the precision part that Jacob mentioned. And what I mentioned before is like sometimes you don't even need that precision. Like you mm-hmm. just need to get the direction right. For example, we have one company. Like our biggest mistake that we ever made was mm-hmm. not buying a very small, obvious German company, which is like a broker,
mm-hmm.
during COVID, because we saw trading volumes spiking
mm-hmm.
and the company was already trading at around 10 times PE on a low basis. And the company fell because of COVID 20%. Mm-hmm. And if you see for a broker, trading volumes quadrupling and the company goes down 20%, then there is something wrong. And we did not buy because we were stressed, because we just had our company opened and like we wanted to, like we still had like a lot of bureaucratic work and all that. And mm-hmm. we'd had no thorough view into the company, but it was like a tenfold within a year afterwards. And I mean, it was obvious, kind of. I mean, it there was some fraud afterwards, like alleged fraud. So it fell like, but only 50%. It still was a really, really good investment. More like a fine that they receive for like banks. They always get those fines.
I want to ask you about this idea about investing, and I think you talked about the precision, how much you have to know and so on. There's this idea that the best investment choices are the ones that have the thinnest folder. And I think Sosnov was an investor that talked about the folder size, and somehow that really spoke to me, how you really, when you think about it, the best investment ideas that work out the best, and it's just an anecdote or experience that I'm speaking of here, but usually I realize that it takes very little to explain the investment case. It takes very little to understand what's going on. And actually the folder itself, if you picture a traditional paper folder, it would have the least paper in it. And the investment cases where you have to do so much research and so much checking and the folder becomes so thick. In that thick folder, I think there might be a lot of things hiding you and they might be hiding from you that may get you in trouble. Do you have some thoughts about that in terms of how big of a folder you really need to pull the trigger on an investment?
So I think when I come back to what is the essence of our work and our advantage to be as brothers, to work together, is once again that we present our ideas to each other. And then mm-hmm. everybody is trying to find things why to and find reasons why not to invest in this company. And that's why I'm totally on with you, Bogomil, here, that the easier the idea is, the more difficult it is for Tobias to find reasons why not to invest.
Yeah. and really it simplifies the process so much. If you can just have it on a napkin, because with actually, also most companies, the things that really matter, if you count them, there's like this Pareto distribution where there's like 20% of the information is worth like 80% or whatever. But like in investing, it seems a little more extreme sometimes even, because all of the companies that we buy, I think there are like 3 to 5 important things you want to know. The problem is before investing, you don't know what those 3 to 5 are.
That's true. And actually what makes money down the road might be something that you did not fully appreciate at the beginning. It might be a surprise, a positive surprise.
Exactly. So though you don't even have to evaluate those. We don't like all those little small positives. We always do not evaluate. We just want them to make us happy afterwards.
I have a lot of questions about dividends and buybacks, but before we get there, I'm curious about cash. And in one of your interviews, you make a point how you were comfortable holding cash in a rising market. And I found it really interesting because I think that it's very difficult for a lot of investors to sit on cash in a rising market. But you were able to do it. Can you talk more about it? What gave you the comfort to sit out and wait?
I mean, actually, we think it isn't difficult because, I mean, the investment process and everything is difficult, but it makes it way easier. Probably it makes it way less exciting, but mm-hmm. I think investing shouldn't be too exciting. Maybe that's what people lose sometimes, but then I can recommend doing some stock picking games where it's not about money, but there you can have like all your energy that you want so much wasted, which you should mm-hmm. for investing. And for our clients, we see a lot that they want to invest more, like many of them, but we don't allow them because they don't know, unless they are invested for like 10 years or so, how they will feel in a downturn. Mm-hmm. And it is just so much more easy to not invest so much.
And for our clients especially, what is better in a market when everything turns against you? What is better than having cash? So we try to set up our clients also that they invest so much that if a stock or if their portfolio goes up, let's say 20% in 1 or 2 years, that they are happy. But mm-hmm. if it falls 20%, they need to be as happy as it would have risen, because they know then, aha, I have some cash left, so let's invest more.
And also two things to add here, like just from a mathematical perspective, cash reduces the cost of capital of the overall portfolio. So mm-hmm. it is worth what it is. It's like not overvalued or undervalued, but it's just what it is. From if you think about the capital structure irrelevance theory, for example. And so there's nothing bad with having a little more cash. And also like people, they love to calculate those optimal portfolio mm-hmm. investments. I mean, I love that too. From the mathematician in me loves that. I mean, I'm not a mathematician, but like the enthusiast, the mathematics enthusiast in me loves that. But it does not help anything because we are human beings, and mm-hmm. like nearly no one is able to hold that optimal position size for 30, 40, 50 years without mm-hmm. having bad sleep. I mean, we ourselves actually have quite a lot invested as percentage-wise, but uh-huh. we did just make it like bigger and bigger every time we like, because we are like in the business now for 15 years, and at first we did not have that much invested, and then like after the third crisis now, we feel a little comfortable with having invested more, but I wouldn't give my clients that.
You're touching on something interesting. So a portfolio that is put together with a formula, with an equation, is not exactly a portfolio that a real human being with emotions, feelings can actually hold. And I think that's something that gets lost in the conversation, how yes, you know, a professor and academic can put together a beautiful portfolio based on all kinds of historical data that says Jacob and Tobias have to be 99% in this or that. But then you wouldn't be able to really stomach the volatility. You wouldn't be able to sleep well. And especially when you accept outside money and you have to take into account other people's emotions, you realize that the best portfolio is the portfolio that both can grow the wealth, but also the portfolio that the client can sleep well holding. And that's harder to accomplish. And it's an ongoing, more nuanced conversation with your client to find out what's the sweet spot, how far can we go, what can we do. It's very different than managing your own money, which is challenging on its own.
Very well said, Bogomil. Very well said.
Yeah, we cannot put it better.
I mean, there's actually two things that I could add here, but that's like just a fun thought experiment, which relates to it, because there's like people that are really, really rich and people that are like don't have that much money. And the thing is, if you crave those optimal portfolios, just calculating the overall performance plus that you receive from that. For those people that don't have that much money, they don't sleep as well, but they in exchange for that, they really do not receive a lot, because like percentage wise of their money, it's not a lot. And also for the really rich people, there is this theory that if you have like $10 million and the next million really does not change your life a lot. And so there is like diminishing returns there. And so here it also does not really help to have the risk associated with like those bigger portfolio positions. So for both kind of people, this is always like a bad thing.
It's very interesting, and there are many ways to look at it. I sometimes look at it as a lifetime of contributions or distributions, and I'll explain what it means. I work with clients who have a sudden wealth moment in their life, whether they inherit wealth or they sell a business or a piece of a business or they get a big compensation. And then in that moment, that sudden wealth will set them up for a potential life of distributions. They might be living off of that capital. So on day one, they have to decide what they have to do with all of it. And it's very different than a life of contributions where you put away 100 or 1,000 every month or so, and then you can average it out, go through ups and downs of the market. You can learn as you go, and you can spend 30, 40 years building your snowball. Very different mindset. And it requires a very different readiness to make decisions. The one with a lifetime of contributions, you really have all this time to learn and tweak and see what works for you. If you have a moment of sudden wealth and tomorrow you have to decide what you're going to do with it, and doing nothing is also a decision, by the way, it's a whole different moment, and it requires a different mindset as well. I don't know if you have thoughts about it.
I mean, I think I cannot add anything that was like perfectly built. And like we have clients and we tell them exactly the same. Often they forget it because like in the process, they have this different mental models that they need when accumulating the money. And then they sometimes forget that shift. But yeah.
It's a different set of risks that you're willing to accept once you have quite a bit. There are certain risks that are just not worth taking at that point. I want to ask you about dividends and buybacks. So there are various ways that the companies can return capital to shareholders. And you've done a lot of studies and research, and you have all kinds of formulas. Can you walk me through how you think about, you look at the business and the management makes a decision about dividends, buybacks in different contexts with different prices and valuations. What's the right way to look at it, and when buybacks make sense? It's not always the case that they do, from what I can tell from your research.
So I think this is our favorite topic for the last, I would say, for the last several years, and especially Tobias. Tobias is in our company. He's more the researcher, as you may can tell already. and I'm more the one who tries to look for investments. And every time I find something or I get problems here and there, it's like I give it to Tobias and say like, Toby, please give me an answer in 2 or 3 days. And then I hear nothing from him. And then I get some mathematical equations and stuff like that. So we have a pretty unusual way of investing, but it's how it works well. And as you just mentioned, Bogumil, with dividends, imagine the following. Imagine you are the owner or you are a shareholder of a holding company, which is not receiving any cash flows because it's just a holding company. And you have, let's say, to get easy numbers, you have assets or let's say stocks or so worth 100. But these are extremely undervalued stocks. So one could say their intrinsic value is double the price of today. So what we found out, or what we are thinking quite a lot, is if the price of this holding is cheaper than their asset value, the company should, and no matter how big their intrinsic value of the stocks is, the company should sell their stocks and therefore buy it back. Because if, for example, you and Tobias, you have 50% of this company, and Tobias suddenly wants to buy for himself a Porsche because he is a big fan of cars, he needs to find a buyer for this company. Then let's say the CEO of this company decides to buy Tobias part of the stock, and therefore he says, okay, the Tobias wants to sell his part, which is worth 50 because he has 50%, and Tobias wants to sell his part for, let's say, 30 because he needs the money so desperately, and therefore the CEO sells the undervalued assets for 30. So the whole net asset value decreases from 100 to 70 and buys back the share from Tobias. And suddenly, Bogumil, you are the only shareholder and your stock or your net asset value is now worth 70 instead of 50. And your intrinsic value was worth, let's say it was before 200. So now with the sale and the buyback, it is still it is worth 140 if we say it's doubled the NAV. And therefore,
But you have like 100% of those 140 and not 50% of 200, which is like more.
And this is actually what we are looking for. And we are working now on a company where, on a holding company, where almost everyone wants to see that the discount is is like getting closed and getting smaller. So if you look at all the internet forums, YouTube videos, stock analysis and Seeking Alpha articles and so on, everyone is focused on how does the company able to close the discount. But we, on the other hand, and this is what we tried to say at the beginning with our investment strategy, we want the discount to actually expand over time, because the company is actually selling their assets, although they are maybe undervalued, and buying back their own shares. And therefore, we get an alpha with the same mathematics as I just told you. And this is just amazing.
Yeah. So like, for example, if the company that we hold now, this holding company, falls 10% today, even though we invested and even though we don't buy more, I will be really happy, because the alpha in the equations would increase by 1%. So if I hold it per year, and if I hold it just 10, 15 years, then I'm better off if it fell today, even if the discount would still stay at that very low price. And if I sell it, like if it goes up and the discount closes, then it's like even better than like in 10 years, because then I have a higher discount and more probability of it closing afterwards. But in between,
I want their company to be as cheap as possible.
So it's a situation when the company itself, the holding company, is undervalued or overvalued, and then the assets, are they undervalued or overvalued? What's the case?
So in the example that Jacob said, the intrinsic value of the portfolio that the company holds was 200. The mm-hmm. market price was 60, let's say, and the NAV, so the mm-hmm. market price of the portfolio positions, was 100. So the portfolio itself is really undervalued, like really. Mm-hmm. And the company itself is also quite undervalued, but not as much as from a percentage wise as the portfolio.
And still, and this is where the big point comes, still the company should sell their very, very undervalued stocks to mm-hmm. buy back.
Think maybe there's this great, great company in the US that is like led by that guru that we all love. think this company is a little bit undervalued. Uh-huh. And everything that he holds is totally undervalued. Then people think, okay, if he buys back, then he thinks his own company is mm-hmm. the better deal than the things that are in his portfolio. That's what people think, because they think in a comparative basis. But no, if his own company is priced lower than what the market price, the total market price of all the positions that he has is, it doesn't matter what the value of the holdings is. Either it's a totally overvalued, undervalued, whatever. It is mm-hmm. always a good idea to sell those stocks and buy uh-huh. back his own, even if it's just a little bit undervalued.
So this is a particular case with a holding company that has some assets to liquidate. What about a big picture idea of a business that has cash flows and then at the end of the year or at some point has to make a decision? Are we going to do dividends or buybacks? How do you think about that? What's the right framework to consider?
So this is a really good question. And like 2 years ago, the first that holding company theory that we worked on was like, I mean, that's quite easy. Because you want a answer now for like a plethora of different companies. Mm-hmm. So you need some more variables mm-hmm. and it makes it actually a little bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. And that's what we worked on the last 2 years. And I'm now in the finishing, on the finishing line to write down that paper with all that. But there is like different examples that we could use here. So, mm-hmm. for example, it is generally thought that undervalued companies should buy back. And this is also true in a sense that if an undervalued company uses its cash flows, the yield that one will mm-hmm. receive will, by definition, always be higher than the cost of capital minus the organic growth. So there will be an alpha, because that's what the definition says of being an undervalued company. The thing is, oftentimes, if you have really great companies that can invest at very, very high returns on invested capital, there are many instances where if the company decides to buy back, people are really happy because they say, oh, it's like the company says it's undervalued. But we are really, really unhappy because it says mm-hmm. that the company is not able to deploy money anymore at those very high returns. And also in the different direction, sometimes it's really a good idea. Like if companies say we don't pay any dividends anymore and we don't do buybacks, it like generally falls. Because mostly it's a good reason behind it, but sometimes it's because they found something where they can invest a lot, like AI or whatever, and mm-hmm. then it falls. But we are really, really, really happy that they do it.
Sometimes it feels like a buyback. It's a vote of confidence. It's almost like an emotional decision that shows, look, I believe in the business and that's why we're doing it and we have the capital to do it. And I think it needs more of the context that you talk about that would be a better use of capital. Go ahead.
I agree. And what Tobias is working on now is having numbers bringing to these equations. I mean, it's always difficult to also for CEOs to find the input variables to like calculate their value. But
this topic in economics where they speak about the physics envy. Probably you know that term. It's supposed that they say like it is we as like economists or economic enthusiasts, we sometimes want to calculate things that we cannot calculate. And because of that theory also, people don't do that much calculation anymore. They just say, okay, this is a quality business or this is a good decision or whatever, because they say there is nothing to calculate. But in many instances, and this is some illness of economics, I think, also. In many instances, there really is an easy way to get the inputs, like not really exactly, but sufficiently exactly, and calculate, being able to calculate what it does to the company. And many investors say that's not possible, so they just don't do it. And for us as investors, it makes it easier, because if people think that it isn't even worth doing, you have like a competition where no one is exercising.
It's interesting. So anecdotally, I can tell how companies usually do buybacks when the price is very high. They feel very good about the future and it's probably not a good time to buy back shares. And then when the stock is down and for very reasons, you know, many reasons, it could be undervalued, they pause buybacks because they're not so sure about the future. So it's kind of when you look, and I'm sure some companies play it out better than the other ones, but I see so many situations where I feel like the buybacks are happening at the worst of times and then they're paused when it would really make sense to do them. So it almost makes me think that maybe it's not the management's role to make those decisions. Maybe it's up to the investors and shareholders to decide if the stock is overvalued or undervalued, and maybe buybacks net don't really benefit us as much as we think. Maybe case by case, it might differ. I don't know if you have some thoughts about that.
I mean, you're right in a sense that there is like, I mean, there's two thoughts here. The first one is that dividends and buybacks, like absent any taxes, actually do have the same yield. So if the company, if we say they shouldn't do buybacks anymore, we simultaneously say they shouldn't do any dividends anymore, because everyone can decide if the company does its own buybacks, because a dividend is just a buyback with a portfolio reallocation. So what everyone can do if the company does the buybacks is just sell some part of those shares. And maybe even sell everything if they think it is overvalued. And but I think your idea is quite good. But the problem, I think, is not really with management. I mean, it is obviously with like the decisions that management makes is not good. But the real problem is, I think, they use the wrong formulas. Because and because there's no scientific consensus yet. So I hope that my paper that will be published shortly clears that up a little bit, because it's also so difficult now, because when they do buybacks, they mostly think about valuation. They think like we are undervalued, or like they think everything will, the future will be so bright. So we need to buy back because the company shares will be so high. And then like the company goes high and high and they buy back more and more. But mostly in most decisions, it shouldn't be about valuation. Also the same with stock issuances, which is like just the negative form of buybacks. Because it's about, for most companies, like in the holding, it is not about the intrinsic value of the company. It is about, in that case, market price to NAV, which is very, very easy to calculate. I mean, management that would get wrong decisions, even with those formulas, I mean, somewhere they would be, but it should be easier then.
So what would be the rule of thumb? You know, you have the CEO, CFO sit down, they have $1 billion left. And should we do buybacks or not do buybacks? What would be a rule of thumb? Let's say they have only 5 minutes to discuss it. They don't have time for the complicated formulas. What would it be?
So actually, the formulas also are like not that complicated if you go through it, but the explanation of all the different circumstances is not that easy. So that takes quite a while. But I'm happy to send my paper to everyone that calls me and wants to know. And because I also like to talk a lot, maybe you can see that. So
Will the paper be made public at some point?
Yes. I'm currently trying to do it with some universities to work with, but like there's so many adjacent theories, and I just don't want to publish it and if it's not complete. But there are some rule of thumbs. I mean, for the holding example, the really good rule of thumb is market price lower than NAV, then you should do always buybacks.
I will include a link so people can follow up with you and see the paper once it's ready. I think it would be fascinating to see what you came up with. And I think there's still, you know, room for a lot of research on the front. So I think it's wonderful that you're doing it. I want to come back for 1 second to the idea that you proposed, you know, dividends and buybacks. The company can say no to both or either. And I think Berkshire is one of the companies that for a long time obviously was not paying a dividend, but only recently considered some buybacks. But when you think about it, as a life cycle of a business, there's a moment for all businesses eventually where they run out of equally attractive places to put the money in. It may happen. I don't know if it's a lack of imagination or it's just a stage of life of a certain business. And then they have this option, what to do with the extra cash that starts to pile up on the balance sheet. And if they're honest with themselves, they were getting certain returns last year and 5 years ago, and they look around for what they can invest in today, and they're not getting the same returns. There's a certain hurdle that they reach. When you're really honest with yourself, you would say, maybe it's not worth for me to be deploying in those lesser businesses or lesser products just to grow and then return the cash to the shareholders. So I think a lot of businesses, especially the more mature ones, reach that point when they have to decide what to do. I want to ask you a follow-up question building on
that. I totally
agree. There are newer companies out there that are go ahead.
No. It was actually just with this really big and mature companies who decide now, although their prices are extremely high, and they decide now to do buybacks. And many people don't get that. Why is this extremely expensive company doing a buyback? But the simple reason is actually that they are not able to reinvest their cash, which is piling up, as you just said, Bogumil. They can't reinvest more money into the business. So obviously they could do they could buy another companies which are cheaper or something like that. But if they are not so sure about that, it could make sense to buy back their stock, although it is pretty expensive.
And like, or if it's like really overvalued, they could do like some allocations to like other stocks, or I mean, they could do even ETFs or whatever, if they want to. One thing which is also just important for that, like many politicians talk about that, so it's like really a polarizing topic. But we think, and this is also what comes out in the paper, that there is some, it is really needed for society that if companies cannot get like ROICs above cost of capital and then investments anymore, then it is really, really important for the company, the shareholders, and really important for society that they don't invest anymore. Because mm-hmm. if they do, the world will get worse for everyone. Or just will not increase the standard of living at an, mm-hmm. at a pace that could be normal. Because every time there is an investment, the negative effects on the investment are not only for the company or for the shareholders, mm-hmm. but it is always inflationary because it's competing for resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so really...
Investing for the sake of investing is not good. That's what you're saying. Just to spend money and expand and build, it's not good by
exactly.
itself. It has to be in a certain context that it meets a certain set of criteria and certain returns that make sense for the shareholder and the benefit of the business.
And that's why we have also capitalism, because we have those companies. Yeah.
Yeah, somehow it evens itself out eventually. So, you know, silly decisions can only last that long, and somehow eventually there is a realization and it ends and stops, and, you know, businesses fail if they poorly invest for too long. Somehow it catches up with them. And I think these days sooner, faster than ever before, but that's just my impression.
True.
I want to ask you about newer companies, because we see this big phenomenon and you're looking at a lot of tech companies. They have two things happening. They have substantial stock issuance to employees, and they're doing buybacks. And when you look at their free cash flow, and somebody put together a study of the big tech companies over the last decade, how much cash flow they created, how much was spent on stock-based issuance and then on buybacks, what are your feelings about it? So let's say you have a company that decides to, you know, has a free cash flow of $5 billion, let's say, and then it has a stock issuance of about $1 billion, and then decides to do a buyback of about $1 billion. What's happening here? Is it a wash? Is it a magic trick? What's really happening with companies like that?
Actually, contrary to the thinking of many, mm-hmm. also value investors, mm-hmm. we don't have a problem with that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is true that this is a washing in the terms of, like, it is a net zero.
Right.
But what happens, like, here is, like, more psychology at work, that mm-hmm. it's like just a part of the wage that the workers receive is mm-hmm. not cash, but just stocks. And mm-hmm. like, if you buy back those same stocks, then you don't change the outstanding shares. And so that's just what you do here.
People get sometimes confused, I think, with stock-based compensation, because it is, when I look at X, or formerly Twitter, people are really talking a lot about stock-based compensation and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But at the end, what it really is, in my opinion, it's just a different kind of salary.
Yeah, yeah. And it is, like, psychologically a mm-hmm. it's good to have
it's an incentive.
It's an incentive. Mm-hmm. That's the word I search for. Yes, thank you. And we think it makes the companies more productive sometimes.
So when I was really thinking about it, what's really happening? So let's say that it's at the same price. You're swapping $1 billion of stock-based compensation for, you know, $1 billion of a buyback. What's really happening? When I thought about it the other day, I realized that you're just trading a certain shareholder for another shareholder. Because on one side, when you're buying back shares, you're retiring some shares. So you're some of your partners in the business, the shareholders leave. You bought them out, and then you're offering those shares. Let's assume for a second that they're the exact same shares to your employees as a stock-based compensation. And obviously they get vested, different price points and so on. So I don't know if it's apples to apples, but close enough in this example.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Are we,
right?
But we are going to use that analogy if we are allowed to.
Please do, please do. I want to see it in your paper. But when you think about it, you're just, if it was a small business with, you know, five partners, you buy out one outside partner, and then you give those shares to somebody that's working for you now and becomes a new partner, the fifth partner, right? It's exactly the same logic. Obviously, for a lot of companies, there might be a disconnect. They're issuing a lot more, you know, 5 billion, and they're buying back only 1 billion. So there are things that shift, but it's really a choice that the company's making. I don't know. I hope it's a very conscious and aware choice of trading a certain shareholder for another shareholder. And it's, you know, the game of musical chairs. Music is going on. People get up, sit down, get up. And then you trade the chairs we are sitting on. It's kind of that kind of a feeling where you just change the shareholder. Is it better? Is it worse? I don't know. I think you can argue both ways, but that's what's really happening. Also, I think if you want your employees to be invested in the company, I think if you have a company that's doing so well and your employees are very happy, it's at the end of the day their choice to put their savings back into the company and say, I like this business so much. I want to stay in this business for the next 10, 20 years. I would love to own a piece of it. And maybe that's a decision that should be left to the employee. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Totally right. And once again, it is, if you have your employees as shareholders and you do not need to give them a salary, therefore,
or like a lesser salary,
you really make your shareholding, your shareholders long-term thinking. And this is actually what I think is really beneficial for a company as well.
And economically, it's like totally it's the same as just giving them the money in that example when it nets out. But like psychologically, I think it's a positive.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the music of chairs, I don't know the English word of that game, but
musical chairs, the game of musical chairs.
Yes.
I feel like it's going to be in your paper too. I'm going to read it in your paper.
Yeah, I like that too. The thing to consider here still is the person that is selling wants to sell.
That's
so actually, it's good if the company buys it back. So it's like not any damage done because they get better prices.
There is a time element to it, and I don't want to make it too complicated for the audience, but when you issue shares and they vest over time and there's a schedule, you know, those shares don't actually appear in the count right away, unless you look at the fully diluted count, but they don't really appear right away. And the buyback happens today, right? So if you decide to do a buyback in the next 3 months, the shares get retired very quickly. There's a time disconnect. So the shares, it creates a bit of an illusion. I think it's a magical trick, and maybe you're going to include it in your paper as well. But if you issue shares and they don't vest for 5 years, those shares are actually, you know, economically part of the experience here down the road. The buyback happens right away. And maybe some companies actually look at it and match the buybacks with the issuance. I don't know. But I feel like management should be more focused on the product development and treating the customers better instead of playing those complicated games. I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well put.
Right?
So I mean, we recommend just also looking at the diluted number of shares because of that, because I mean, that's the real number. The only reason to not use it is we could say that for some reason, not all of the shares are going to be vested. But that's only if the people are leaving, which is also probably not a good sign.
I think at times it feels like that magician that's sitting in the square on a little chair with two little cups and a red ball, a yellow or a red ball, and then pushes the ball from left to right, from left to right, and then asks you in which cup the ball is. But at the end of the day, it's just one ball, right? You know, one stream of cash flows that the business has. And it's kind of a magic trick. Is it more the employees or is it more the outside investors? And usually it shouldn't matter too much. But when you look at some of the tech companies, the stock-based compensation, sometimes it's, you know, 20 or 30 or 40% or more of the free cash flow. There's a humongous reallocation happening, and hopefully, you know, for the benefit of the business. But it's something that I think it's a fascinating phenomenon, especially recently.
obviously, yes, it is crazy sometimes. And the managers and people, it is, you can easily use these things as a pyramid scheme or something like that. Uh-huh. These issuances and buybacks and like you said, with the ball and like change the cups so yeah. often that no one understands what's really happening. But this is obviously why I think our Oracle from Omaha is saying you need to invest in companies where you trust management because
exactly.
And there is there is this pyramid scheme. What Jacob mm-hmm. just said also fits really well because that's in the paper that if we go through all of the mathematics, I'm mm-hmm. not going to spill too much now, but if we go through the mathematics in some cases, it really resembles mm-hmm. pyramid schemes, and you could do it so beautifully in a legal uh-huh. way. Uh-huh. It is like, it's a problem.
We won't do it, though. not that the audience is thinking that we are building here something with Toby's theories. We just want to point out these theories.
Maybe if it's not in the paper, you're doing... you know why.
You found the magic trick. But I think what you're pointing out is, you know, a certain practice that makes sense and a lot of practices that are not in the long run good for the shareholder. And I think any research on that front, I think, can improve the future quality of how capital is allocated. I think it's a big question of how businesses actually think about capital allocation, and not just in terms of a short-term move in a stock price, but actual value creation and what's the role that they can have. And with those moving targets and buybacks and stock-based comp and dividends are the most straightforward, you know, it's cash that I can see, but everything else, it has a bigger context. The stock is undervalued, overvalued, and so on. I want to ask you a big question, and it's my last one for today, about a definition of success. You've been winning some awards. You are transforming your family business into an investment vehicle. You're accepting outside clients. You're both very young, and now Paulie is accepting an award today with a nice car. You can mention what kind of a car is he going to drive away today from Frankfurt, where I'm finding you. But tell me about success. How do you both think about success? What's it like for you?
So yes, Paulie is our youngest brother, and as I said before, we are five boys. Maybe quickly, mm-hmm. I want to mention out here once again before we come to the before I come to answering the success. So. Because we were talking a lot about childhood at the beginning, and we need to really thank there also our mother. Mm-hmm. Because Bogumil, as you can imagine, uh-huh. We have five boys, and the main topics on our dinner table were investments and cars.
And uh-huh. every dinner, really. not only in the night, but also on the middle of the day. And also sometimes when we uh-huh. went for coffee. Also, like all time only investing, economics, whatever.
And back then, uh-huh. we didn't appreciate what my mother was doing for us back then, mm-hmm. because she obviously would have topics she wanted to talk more about. But uh-huh. she also, I think in retrospect, invested really a lot of her time, of her hobbies, and she like put her interests back for us to learn more about investing and yeah cars, but it's not so important. But
this also really relates very well to our definition of success, I think.
And what I want to say is, with all these great guests you had in your podcast, I think that we are not able to answer this question, but. Uh-huh. What I like to think about is actually to have, what we are trying is to be net positive with our actions. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something everyone can achieve because we are in such a different field. Like, for example, my almost wife, Laura, mm-hmm. she's actually mm-hmm. a teacher. And mm-hmm. there she is doing so much for getting the youth and the kids and giving them perspectives, because she is like in schools, and she was especially in Vienna, where she was working with really with kids who had not even as close of a privileged life than Tobias and I had from the beginning on. But what I really like about your podcast, Bogumil, you're always saying every little gesture matters.
It does.
And this is basically what we try to do, to be like net positive. And I think this is something, if everyone would think of it and if everyone would like to achieve it, it is, the world could be also net positive.
I like that.
And I mean, just if we think about that, like sometimes people say they want to have like a net positive effect on like their overall life. And like they sometimes people think they are so good in some area and they did so much like philanthropic work or whatever ever that they can do like evil stuff sometimes, or like things that are not good for other people, right? Because they say they are still net positive. But we define it more that in every area that we can aggregate, there should be a net positive effect. Because you cannot say I'm such a good have such a good impact on the world, so I can beat my wife or cheat on her. Like that's what happens a lot sometimes. Because it is difficult if you really we think of having success as having a good life. And it is really difficult if you think from a mathematical perspective how you could have a good life if you don't know the weights of the inputs. And so it's similar than like in the investing area where we just don't talk about the quantities or the inputs or the weight of the inputs, but just on the total like the benefit. Direction. If it's if it's like yes.
I like the net positive because I think it gives you the awareness that not everything will be positive. I mean, by definition, it's very hard to aim for such a perfection. We all hope to do that. And I like what you mentioned about the smallest gesture, because it doesn't have to be something big, but those things compound as well. The kindness, the goodness, and the little things in the world. And
really?
Your future wife, you know, is teaching the next generation. And that has a huge impact on who those young people will become and what kind of a role they will play in our future lives. And it's a remarkable thing to consider. So I like the way it sounds.
And it helps you also a lot because like some people think that the successful life is like amassing like billions of dollars or whatever, which is obviously a good thing if you are able to do that. But and just like having also fun in life, which you should also have, like if there is like this energy and you can capture it, please capture it. But it is important that you have also a mentality that is not fragile. And this is really important for investing, but also for life. There you have like those up phases and down phases, and you need some strategy that works in both phases. And if you're just wanting like the ultimate pleasure in life or investing, then on the upsides is really great, but on the downsides you really doubt the meaning of life or whatever. But if you focus more on other people and on helping other people in that sense, even if you have a down phase and you think that life is not worth living or whatever, even then you have that sense of meaning, because the other people, like there are always some that feel good and some that feel bad, and you can help both. And then your impact, if it's positive, you can you get way less fragile. So that also helps with that, probably.
Yeah, that's a great observation, how in life and investing there will be trying times and you have to find a way. And whether it's the support of the family that you all have and the five of you and sitting down and talking about investments, I think it's a great and wonderful environment for you to flourish. and that can help you take the long-term view and make it through the tough times. And from what I heard, actually turning those tough years in the market for times of opportunity and buying up some incredible businesses. That's what I've been hearing for the last hour with you both. So I think you've found a formula that works. You're having fun with it and you have an incredible runway ahead of you. I feel like I was your age 5 minutes ago, but it was longer than that. And I remember those days when I was discovering, you know, investing in the books and reading Peter Lynch and Buffett and everybody else. And it never left me. So I have to tell you that it's an excitement and passion and you can keep all your life. And I was listening to Munger and his interview at 99 the other day. And I'm thinking, I want to be him when I grow up. I want to be as passionate about all of this when I'm 99. So I think that's what you both aspire to as well, from what I'm hearing.
Exactly. Like, yep. love in general within you and like for what you're doing is probably, it's a mixture. Success probably is a mixture of all of those things. Also, like those that you mentioned, that manga is like really a source for all that wisdom.
Yeah, they're both an inspiration. But you guys are as well. I mean, you discovered investing so early. You're in your 20s and you're having so much fun. And I can only imagine where you're going to be in the next few decades. So I'm really excited to follow your successes. And I'm looking forward to that paper. I'm curious how many of the things we talked about today will end up in that paper. So I'm curious to see it. And I'll include it in the notes. And hopefully by the time this episode goes out and gets released, this paper will be ready. But I want to thank you for today. I know you're going to run and see Paulie accept an award and drive away in a nice car. Do you want to say what kind of a car he's driving away today?
Yes,
at
it's
that award ceremony?
It's a Jaguar E-Pace.
Jaguar.
All right. Well, beautiful. That's a nice car.
Yeah. One of our nicest that we receive in those games.
And I have to say that it's not the first car that you boys won. Is that true?
Yeah, it's like the fourth now. So
the fourth car.
Yeah.
There you go. So you have a collection. I'm guessing you sold some of those and you bought some Coca-Cola shares with them, but I'm not going to ask.
Yeah, we have to finance our obsession over Coca-Cola, also like the drinking. So we need to sell those.
It's a tough choice between Coca-Cola shares and another nice car. But thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for today. I had a lot of fun talking to you both.
Thanks a lot, Bogumil.
Thank you, Bogumil. Really, we feel honored to be here.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Sicard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.